Mark Mothersbaugh, thank you for being on Around Cincinnati, and thank you for bringing this very unique and wonderful show to our town.
It's my honor to be here.
Tell me just a little bit about this show. It's Myopia?
Yes.
And what is the idea behind this? It's a little bit personal, and it's a little bit social, maybe even a little political.
It was something I never thought would happen in my lifetime, to be honest with you. In the last about 15 years, I've done about 150, maybe a little more than that, gallery shows. And I've chosen on purpose mostly street galleries and graffiti galleries just because I have a day job in Hollywood that puts me working with people that I get to work on these films mostly and TV shows, but they tend to come in my studio and talk about business all the time. And you don't always talk about what got you there in the first place, which is art. And what got you excited about doing what we're doing, it becomes abstract after a point. I was a visual artist before I was a musician, actually, and the guy I started Devo with, Jerry Casale, we were both in the art department at Kent State when we started the band. So I kept doing gallery shows and kept doing visual shows, but I picked small galleries on purpose so that I could hang around with these people that were young and still excited about art. And never thought this kind of a museum retrospective would happen until after I was buried with just one leg sticking out of the ground. Then I met this museum director in Denver. We were talking about a film director from the 60s who had done a Devo video named Bruce Conner. And he started looking at my stuff and he said, well, there might be something here to check out. And he went into my warehouses and saw that I had a body of work that dated back into the 60s. He put together this project with me, and I picked the title Myopia because it was my first pair of glasses that inspired me to want to be an artist.
In what way? How did that come about?
I had gone through kindergarten, first and second grade, not knowing that I was legally blind. I was one of five kids, and it's not an atypical story. This is something that's very common with nearsighted and astigmatic children, that you can see just enough through the fog that you can actually function fairly well. But by the time you get to school, you can't read and you can't see further than 6 inches in focus from your face. So my teacher just thought I was being a jerk when she'd say, okay, Mr. Mothersbaugh, read the numbers and add them up on the blackboard. And I'd go, what is a blackboard? And the kids would laugh. And then she'd go, all right, smart man, get in the corner or go to the office. And I'd get spanked, and I'd go, how do the other kids know the right answer? How do they know what to say? I was always kind of amazed that other kids knew what to say when she asked them. At the end of second grade, she saw me with my face about 2 inches from the paper writing things and suggested I got my eyes checked. And when they did, they said, oh, he can't see the big E even from further than 6 inches away. So I got a pair of glasses at the end of second grade, the last week of second grade, and left the optometrist, and we drove over a hill that was right above my elementary school, and I saw Newberry Elementary School for the first time in my life. And I said, that's the school I go to. I couldn't believe it. And I saw the woods that I walked through every day, and I saw the housing development I lived in, and I saw what the roof of a house looked like. I saw hundreds of them. And I'd never seen the roof of a house or a chimney before. And I never saw smoke come out of a chimney before. And I'd never seen clouds. And I'd never seen birds flying in the sky. And I'd never seen the sun. And I was amazed. I could not believe it. And I was telling my dad all these things that I was seeing that I'd never seen. And I'd never seen a tree before. I'd never seen the top of a tree. I only knew the part that I ran into when I was playing in the yard with my friends. And so the next day I was drawing pictures of a tree. And my teacher, Mrs. Savory, who had spanked me, who had made me stand in the corner, who had sent me to the office, who had given me detention, she's looking over my shoulder and she said, you draw trees better than me. And that was the first nice thing any teacher had ever said to me. And I went home that night and dreamt I was going to be an artist.
Well, it's amazing that you went 5, 6 years of your life.
Seven.
And then literally the world was revealed to you.
I saw it as something lucky. I've had people say, well, weren't you angry about that, that nobody noticed before? And it never occurred to me to think about it that way when I was a kid. I just saw it as like, oh, something great just happened. I felt like I just got this big secret revealed. So I just kind of took it the other way. and it became this wonderful treasure instead.
I also got my first pair of glasses in second grade, so I can kind of identify that. My astigmatism probably wasn't as strong as yours, but it was something I dealt with through my entire life until I got LASIK surgery, and that changed everything. Is that something you never really wanted to do?
When they first had contact lenses, my astigmatism was so bad that it didn't really help. And I have to say that nothing, including orgasms, felt as good as taking a contact lens out of my eye, the kind of contacts that they had back in 1967, 68. Then I tried them again later, but it was like I'd gone so long with wearing glasses, I just felt like I needed that fisheye lens view of the world at that point to live in. That's the world I lived in. And it felt weird when all of a sudden I went to this other world that had a different view of a perspective. And I liked the idea that I could still take my glasses off and all of a sudden the whole world would go away and I would be in this fog. I'd be in this other world at night when I went to bed. And I'd wake up and I'd have to find my glasses and then I'd be in the real world again or the other world again.
And then let's take that to the social aspect of myopia. What is the social implication of that title and how does it relate to the artwork that's in this exhibit?
I think that the show represents just one man, one human out of however many billions we have right now, one person's perspective of the world. You're just seeing one person who traveled through life. You're seeing their perception and their view of how the Earth is and how life is on planet Earth right now. That's as far as I've taken it.
I've been reading reviews and descriptions of this exhibit, and time again, the words that come up are prolific because this is a body of work that has spanned pretty much your entire career. And I've heard it referred to as pop surrealism. Is that pop art and surrealism and things like that? Are these movements and types of art that you were aware of at a young age and were they heavily influential in your own development?
Yeah, I think so. When I was at school, I went to Kent State. And when I was at school, I was exposed to everything. And I became really interested in all the art movements in Europe between World War I and World War II, especially. I loved the Surrealists and the Dadaists, especially. I loved the Dadaist movement. But I loved the Futurists in Italy. And I think if they were alive now, they would feel vindicated in their proclamations that the modern orchestra, the symphony, doesn't have the instruments that are required to create the sounds, to properly make the sounds necessary to illuminate modern culture. So they would add like foghorns and they would add airplane propellers and things like that. And at the time, people ridiculed them and made fun of them. But I think if they heard electronic instruments, they would be so intrigued with what has happened in music.
Tell me about some of the pieces that are in this exhibit and what types of pieces. I know you have various themes. You do prints, you do rugs, you have sculptures, you do postcards. Are all of these pieces in this exhibit or are there certain ones that are left out?
There were about 1,000 different pieces collected for this show, and most of them are going to be on display. A lot of them are in these journals that I've kept since the early 70s. Because of my vision, I got used to, at an early age, drawing from about 6 inches away because I could only hold perspective. Even with my prescription, although it would give me 20/20, it would not fix perspective. So I would have 20/20, but it would give me this extreme, like, fisheye lens look. So although it was in focus, it would still be like looking in a doorknob in focus. Although it was no longer fog vision, it was fisheye. 24 hours a day whenever I wore my glasses. And to this day, it still is. When I'm moving my head up and down in the room right now, I can make the corners of your room bend about a foot on each side of my lens. And you just learn to, in your mind, it automatically accommodates for that. So just remember that. Don't get on the back of a motorcycle with me or have me play outfield for you ever. So I've always drawn on this small format. Because of that, I became attracted to something called mail art back in the early 70s, which back when people used to actually put things in the mail, artists used to send mail, and especially Dadaists used to send artwork on postcards to each other. And I found out that even just being like a nobody in Akron, Ohio, I could send a postcard to somebody like Robert Indiana or Jasper John's or Irene Dogmatic out in San Francisco or Ant Farm or Image Bank up in Canada, that these people, they would send me back a postcard oftentimes. And when you're like a 20-year-old kid and you just feel like you're nobody, it kind of was amazing. It was an amazing feeling to get that kind of reinforcement that I'm touching something that Robert Indiana touched, that he made. So I kept making these cards, and it was easy because it was a size that I could hold the perspective on. Then I started realizing that I was making these cards. They were about things that had happened during the day, and they were about things that related to this band I was starting with these guys that were my friends, and we were calling it Devo. I was writing lyrics, and I thought, well, wait a minute, I don't want to mail these out. And I started saving them, and I was a stamp collector, so I knew that you could buy these archival books for like a couple bucks. You could buy these red books that had archival pages in them, and they would hold 100 cards the size that I made. So every time I got 100 cards, I'd go buy another one of those books, and I'd put them in, and then I'd put it on the shelf. So now it's like 350 or 375 books later. There's quite a few of them that'll be in this show, maybe 300 or more.
I was going to ask you if there was an interesting feeling in the process of making this, for what lack of a better term, piece of art, and then sending it away.
Well, sending it away was kind of, I liked it because it was going to somebody that I liked. So I didn't even think about it going away until it had something that I thought I needed. And then once I thought of it that way, then it became like my image bank. Then it became something I thought, well, wait a minute. If that's the lyrics for Comeback Johnny, maybe I should save it. That's how I ended up starting to save them.
I'd like to speak a little bit about this exhibit that's coming to the Contemporary Art Center. As part of this exhibit, you're having a presentation at the opening, and there's also a performance that you're calling Music for a Six-Sided Keyboard. What is that all about?
I collect esoteric and eccentric instruments from all different times because I write so much music. Over 20 years ago, after Devo went to California and got a record deal, and then it kind of went sour, and then we were trying to decide what we were doing. A friend of mine, Paul Rubin, asked me to score his TV show, Pee-wee's Playhouse. And I thought, okay, I'll try that. And I'd done like 6 or 7 albums with Devo. And what that meant is you write 12 songs, you rehearse them, you go into a studio and record them, you then rehearse them for a tour, you like make a film, then you go out and tour, come back and write 12 more songs. It's like a year. So every year you got to write 12 more songs. Well, when I said I'd do his TV show for him, he sent me a tape on Monday. I got the first episode of Pee-wee's Playhouse. On Tuesday, I wrote enough music that was equivalent to 12 songs. On Wednesday, I recorded it. On Thursday, because there was no internet, I would put it in a box and send it to New York where he was editing. And then Thursday, they would cut it into the show. On Friday, they would give it to the network, and they would get it ready for TV. And on Saturday, we'd watch it on TV. And on Monday, he sent me another tape. And it meant I got to write 12 more songs. And I was like, sign me up for this. This is great. Because as much as I love to do Uncontrollable Urge and Jocko Homo over and over again in concerts, the idea of writing new songs and writing new music every week to me was much more exciting. I really wanted to work in that world.
Well, and that has obviously branched out and exploded for you. You're doing lots of film scores now. What is different about writing music for a score as opposed to performance? Obviously, there's usually no lyrics. The time frame of the song is often very different. What's the difference in approaching that?
Some things are the same. It's collaborative. You know, it's like with Devo. Devo wasn't a band, or isn't, because we still do things. It's not a band where one guy controlled the band and told everybody what to do. It's like we were two sets of brothers, and we were all collaborative. And any song, whether it had my name only on it, like Uncontrollable Urge or Jocko Homo, or whether it had all of our names on it, everybody kicked in a little bit, you know, and all had an opportunity to say something. And if they had a good idea, we would incorporate it. It was a collaborative thing always. It's the same with film. It's kind of a collaborative thing. You work with the director and they need things from you. And they have ideas of what they were trying to do with their film. And they need help with getting where they're trying to go. And you look at it and you go, I know what we could do. And you have ideas and you play them for them. And some of them they really like and some of them scare them. And some of them, they scare them at first and then they come around to it. Like a couple of weeks later, they get braver or they figure out that, oh, wait a minute, that was a great idea. It's a different process, but it's interesting because it's like you go from writing all the music and then you perform it with anything from just one guitar or a few instruments or a jazz quartet or to a 100-piece orchestra, like Lego Movie. I had 99-piece orchestra, about 60 synths, and a 35-piece choir all playing at the same time. That was like our fourth movie we'd done together, and we knew each other and trusted each other really well. So I went to Australia to record it without them. They were filming 22 Jump Street at the same time, but I knew that they need a lot of choices when they're on their final mix, so I scored it so they could have either at any time, they could have dialed it so it was more electronic, or they could have dialed it so it was more symphonic. So you could take that score that I did for them and you could have mixed it almost a totally electronic score. Not totally, because there were some cues where I just did them symphonic and there were some cues that I did just electronic. But you could have done two totally different sounding soundtracks for that film easily. And I did that just to cover them. So you have all different kinds of possibilities. And like the song, Everything is Awesome, we started that way before the score. God knows how many versions of that got recorded before the ones that ended up in the film got there.
Like you said, you started with Pee-wee's Playhouse. You've worked with the Rugrats franchise. You do appearances on Yo Gabba Gabba. You worked with the Lego Movie. Is there a certain appeal to doing music for programs that have a primarily younger audience?
I like that kind of stuff because what I find out is when you work with kids' shows, and especially the Pee-wee thing was like such a great way to start off because they were all in New York and I was in L.A. by myself, so there was nobody telling me what to do. And my only directives from the director, Steven Johnson, who passed away last year, were if it's scary, make it really scary. If it's sad, make it really sad. And if it's happy or crazy, make it really crazy. He just wanted extremes. And they let me pick instrumentation myself. I mashed up musical styles. And with kids, it's all new to them. So they are accepting of all sorts of things. You know, when you're writing adult comedies and a lot of different stylizations, they're expecting a certain kind of music. They want to hear things like they've heard before. They don't want it to be something new. Their idea of new is like a very small baby step oftentimes. So writing for kids is great for that. And then other times you find a director who lets you be more creative, like Wes Anderson, for instance. I've done like 4.5 films with him, and he's always fun to work with.
Mark Mothersbaugh, thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
The exhibit Myopia is at the Contemporary Arts Center, opening September 25th and running through January 9th. For links to more information about the exhibit, you can go to wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. I'm Jim Nolan.